You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast, coming to you from my closet. I'm your host, Sarah Custer. Here we are at the beginning of April in the middle of a novel coronavirus pandemic that has caused the world to screech to a grinding halt. Universities around the world have closed campuses or severely limited face-to-face classes and, quite miraculously, transferred all their operations online. The nature of the spread of this virus means that different parts of the world are in different phases of response. Asian countries were the first hit with lockdowns in early February, which is a situation some countries in the West are only now beginning to realize. Asian universities have been in crisis mode the longest, so in this episode, we're looking at how they've responded and what it could tell us about the long-term impacts to higher education. I'm speaking with Times Higher Education's Asia editor, Joyce Lau, about the response from universities in Hong Kong, and Hamish Coates, a professor in Tsinghua University's Institute of Education and deputy director of the Tsinghua University Global Research Center for the Assessment of College and Student Development. First, let's go to Joyce Lau, who begins by reminding us that Hong Kong universities already had experience of taking classes online when they closed campuses during student protests last November.
Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Sarah.
How are you doing in Hong Kong?
We're doing fine.
You guys are kind of coming out of this a little bit. What's the situation right now for you?
Well, it's been a long haul here, so Hong Kong had its first cases in January, which were imported from mainland China. So we have had social distancing now for more than 2 months, but not as strictly as you guys have in the UK. So it's a little different. We have a little more freedom to move around, but we've kind of been at it for a lot longer. So we are, there's been sort of, Hong Kong actually went down to almost no new cases for a bit. And then we had this boomerang, because when the cases started to rise in the West, a lot of the students who had been in the UK or the United States or Australia started coming home. They started coming back to Hong Kong. So we had this kind of weird thing where the virus was coming under control, but then we've had all these imported cases of basic, a lot of them are returnees, a lot of them are returnee students. So the cases have gone up a bit more, although I still think the containment in this part of the world is better than we've seen in parts of the West.
And obviously universities are still, campuses are still closed and they're still doing all delivery online.
Yeah, so Hong Kong is quite unique in that our universities, well, to be accurate, the in-person classes and exams have been suspended and moved online. Campuses are still open in that there are still people on them. There are students in some dorms. There are some professors who are in their offices. So they're not entirely shut. But obviously, if there are no classes and exams, there's no real need for most people to be there. It's been a long time. So our in-person classes and exams moved online in November because of protests, not because of the virus. That was supposed to be a short couple-week suspension. And then after Christmas, I think they went back for a couple of weeks in January, but then coronavirus hit. And so they went back online. So Hong Kong's education has moved online now for 5 months. We're 5 months into this experiment.
And just in your conversations that you've had with universities, has that transition been smooth just because of the history that they've had and kind of the experience that they've had of having to take things online quite rapidly as a result of the protests?
Yeah, it's funny. I was at a THE event actually in November in London, and I remember speaking to UK academics who were asking, because the protests at that point were on the news every day. And I remember telling them that Hong Kong academics had to go online. There was really no choice. It wasn't an option. At that time, I think it was very, very stressful. Whether it went smoothly, I guess, is relative. It wasn't perfect. It's very difficult to move an entire university online. But I think relatively, it went pretty well. it our universities are already pretty high tech. A lot of stuff is already online. Our student population are very digital, but it's not perfect. In November, educators were asked to put everything online. This is all educators, from primary teachers to, you know, people overseeing PhD dissertations. And whether it went smoothly is relative. It wasn't 100% smooth. It would never be. You have a huge range of tech ability. You have a huge range of different subjects. But I think, relatively speaking, it did go smoothly because they did do it in the end. Mm. I know that Hong Kong's universities tend to be quite tech-savvy. They have very good IT teams. They were already producing MOOCs. They were already doing online learning. I spoke to Ian Holliday at the University of Hong Kong, who made a really good point that while Hong Kong, you had MOOCs and other online learning, it was sort of like optional. The professors who were more tech-savvy were more likely to engage in that. But after all this happened, there was a shift in culture. It wasn't optional, it was mandatory. Everyone had to go online.
So, yeah, you guys are probably 4 to 6 weeks ahead of where Europe and the U.S. are with this. And the conversations that we're having right now are just about making sure that it is as smooth a transition as possible for all students, that all students are being supported, both in their learning, but also for their mental health and responding to this. Likewise for faculty who are dealing with taking care of small children, but also trying to support their students and keep their own mental health in check. What sorts of conversations are you guys having now? And did you have these conversations whenever you were at this point, the same point that we are in now?
I think part of, I think Asian universities or Asian societies are quite good on the technical aspects. I think they are less strong, and this is not just universities, I think it's our societies and our governments in general. They're less strong on the human aspect. There's certainly less of a social safety net, whether it's labor practices or unemployment insurance. And I think that mentality is carried over, that there really weren't as many conversations about, for example, supporting working parents or supporting students financially or mentally. There have been conversations, but not as much as we're hearing in the West. I think they're taking a different approach. So in terms of a technical shift, it was really pretty impressive that they got everything online in a couple of weeks. I see two upcoming challenges. So as you say, we are several weeks or even a couple of months ahead of the West in terms of the progress of this virus and the closure of our universities. One thing is assessments. How do you do exams? Mm. So that's very different from teaching a class. You teach a class, you get on Zoom, you upload your PowerPoints, you record some videos. But in a way, the student takes that quite passively. An exam is different. And there are also a lot of security concerns and proctoring and making sure people don't cheat. So that is our next big hurdle, because the universities did some exams at the end of last term, so before the Christmas break. Now we're heading into our second term of this. We're heading into finals, which would probably be in a couple months. The University of Hong Kong has created a system called OLEX. It's an online exam system. Mm-hmm. The University, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, is also piloting a few systems. But there are also talk, there's been a lot of talk about whether replicating an in-person mass exam is what we want to do. Maybe this is an opportunity for us to rethink how assessments are done. Mm. I know Hong Kong U has given some flexibility on the weight of assessments. So maybe before, your final exam was worth a certain percentage, but maybe now you give a greater percentage to participation or coursework. For example, we have a college entrance exam called the DSE, and that's been delayed. And even with the delay, we don't know if we can hold it because it's a lot of high school kids sitting in classrooms together.
Hmm.
And there are conversations about, is there another way, like, do we need to stick to this method where once a year kids take a really stressful exam in person in the classroom?
Hmm.
Maybe we can assess kids in other ways. Maybe we can look at their classwork or their coursework or their mock exams, or maybe this will actually change the way that we assess kids, not just technically. UST, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, they've been quite ahead on online proctoring. There's all sorts of technical things you can do. For example, you can check the student's ID card via your laptop cam.
Mm.
You can lock down certain browsers and applications so that students can't, like, Google the answers.
Mm-hmm.
You can use what they call live person proctoring, which is someone's physically sitting at a computer watching the student.
Mm.
I don't know how this is going to work for mass exams. It seems like it would require a lot of staff and a lot of bandwidth. And so there are other conversations saying, do we need to replicate old-fashioned exams where everyone sits in a giant room?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, clearly this is kind of pushing discussions about questioning the status quo and questioning established systems and ways of doing things. How do you think, once this is all hopefully blown over, hopefully soon, what sorts of impacts do you think this is going to have on higher education teaching and learning just in general, now that we've kind of proven that it is possible to do everything online?
There's a lot of talk about a hybrid, where obviously we all want to go back to campus. Everyone misses going to campus, like teachers, students, even me. Like, when I was reporting before this, I loved going to see professors in their labs or in their classrooms, or to walk around a campus and to see anything, whether it's a gym or a student performance. There's a whole aspect of higher education that is missing, because your university experience is not just looking at a teacher for an hour and turning in your homework or taking an exam. I think they're looking at a hybrid model where, of course, we do want to go back to campuses with all the richness and the diversity of activities that offers, but that some things can be digitized, because honestly, all these systems that they've built are now built. They're there. I was speaking to one professor who said it depends on the course. If it's Calculus 101, which is normally taught in the classroom with hundreds of kids anyway, if you're sitting in the back, you're watching it on a screen anyway, there's no reason we can't just make that a MOOC now. But if you're talking about a small group project in a lab or a one-on-one discussion for your PhD dissertation, then that still has to be done in person. That's something that has been lost with the e-learning. So maybe there'll be a hybrid. Maybe, for example, if you have an overseas exchange program, instead of having someone overseas for 3 months, you do 2 months of online learning and 1 month of intensive overseas travel. I mean, maybe we can rethink the way that we balance digital learning and in-person learning.
Interesting. And there have been discussions about this potentially even improving access to higher education. Do you think that's a viability with this?
I don't know. I think it cuts both ways. On the flip side of that, there is a concern that students who come from disadvantaged backgrounds will be even more disadvantaged, and that there's kind of a digital divide.
Mm.
Right now, Hong Kong started this experiment. Hong Kong is a very small, dense, relatively affluent and digitized society. If you look at mainland China, it's huge. It's more than a billion people. It's hugely diverse, from, you know, very modern cities like Shanghai to very poor rural areas. Whether all students have equal access to broadband, Wi-Fi, laptops, we just don't know. Like, this is a big question mark, and I think we need to be a little further down this journey to know whether kids will be left behind. I know that when you're on campus, when you're sitting in the classroom, in a way, you're kind of equal to everyone else sitting in the classroom. And I know that, for example, at Hong Kong U, and I'm sure it's true at other places, the student union was offering, like, discounted laptops. You can go to the library. You can go to a computer lab. Like, you have access to things. If you're sitting in your home, you're only limited to what you have in your home. If you're sitting at home and there's five people in a tiny flat and you're all sharing, you know, two mobile phones, maybe you really can't do online learning.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Joyce. I know you're quite a few hours ahead of me, so I appreciate you spending a Friday afternoon chatting with me about this.
Okay. Bye, Sarah.
When the virus broke out in China, the president of Tsinghua University acted quickly. The elite institution went from offering 150 classes online to over 2,000 in a number of weeks. Like universities in Hong Kong, though, their next challenge will be assessments. But Professor Hamish Coates expects to see great innovation in online assessment as a result of the situation.
Hamish, can you tell me a little bit about, Tsinghua obviously had a very strong response to the pandemic, transferring all of your classes online for a huge university and a huge student base. Would you just remind us of what the time frame of that was to go from offering about 150 classes online in early February to over 4,000 now?
Yeah, so what happened is essentially everyone went to leave for the Spring Festival holiday, and it became clear that there was a viral problem in Wuhan, and quickly our leadership determined that that was going to grow into being a problem for the conduct of the spring semester's education. So towards the end of January, a series of leadership meetings were held in the university. They quickly determined that the option was to shutter the campus and defer the start of classes, or to shift the university online. And a decision was made to shift the university online, the whole university. And to put this into some perspective for those people who aren't so familiar with Tsinghua, it's the world's most elite university to get into. It's gated, it's residential, it's incredibly high touch and high experience, and the students are very elite. So all of that, if you like, with not much formal online education, was almost turned completely 180 into, if you like, the world's first ever experiment of elite online formal education. Of course, we've had MOOCs, and universities have been teaching online around the world for 20, 30 years in some instances, but never really has a university done so solely and at the same time closed down their campus. So what we saw is an amazing transformation of a university. Faculty had 2 weeks after the president gave the first class, which was done on the 3rd of February, to prepare their materials. And by the 17th of February, when we started teaching, about 2,700 faculty were delivering 4,000 online courses to about 25,000 students spread across every time zone and probably up to around 100 countries. Keeping in mind that students and faculty had just gone on holiday, so they were outside of the university when all this happened. So it was quite a quick turnaround. And for now, I suppose, coming on 6 or 7 weeks, we've been delivering what I would refer to as emergency online learning. We have to be pretty careful not to just say we're doing online learning, because I dearly hope we do reopen the campus at some point and we go back to having campus-based education. And secondly, the sort of online learning that we're doing now it's the sort of online learning you do in an emergency. It's not the same as the premium, really sophisticated forms of online learning that many firms and universities have been working on for some decades. The way that the online education business has flowed in recent years is that it has become incredibly sophisticated. There's a whole ecosystem of ed tech firms. It's incredibly centred on China, more or less Shenzhen and Beijing, and Zhejiang, but also the US. It's billions of dollars of business and venture capital. And they have started to come up with some really super sophisticated ways of doing education. You know, reconfiguring curriculum, allowing people to learn across different sorts of platforms, working through language barriers, having real-time feedback based on how learners are interacting with the technology and how teachers are interacting with learners to ensure that people are doing things really well. Teams of psychologists who support students and make sure that they're not at risk of dropping out, and all sorts of additional experiences. We see this through the commercial platforms, but we also see it through a number of non-profit platforms as well. And of course, several of those are associated with universities. And in China, many are associated with Tsinghua. So while we haven't done a lot of formal online learning within the university programs itself, at the end of the street, we do have the third biggest MOOC in the world, Shedang X, and there's an enormous number of faculty who develop online learning platforms and teach online, and we have a large number of SPOCs that we also use to teach internally and an online teaching platform, the Rain Classroom.
Sorry, Hamish, just to interrupt you, tell us what SPOC is, S-P-O-C?
Yeah, SPOC is basically a small private open course, so that's essentially where a faculty will use their own course or their own MOOC or another MOOC, and they will use that within the classroom on the campus. We have a situation where really sophisticated online learning involves teams of people who we now refer to as education engineers, redoing curriculum, making sure that the teaching's done seamlessly, it's reactive to individual needs, it has really great assessment. In emergency online learning, I think we also have a situation where people are basically doing what it takes to do the teaching and provide students with an ongoing education experience using a whole range of platforms. That's the difference. The really interesting question is how these two come together in the future.
Because Tsinghua had, you had your own MOOC platform that you've been working on for about 3 years, Rain.
In around 2011-12, Tsinghua forged a partnership with edX and Coursera and has provided a gateway and a platform for offering global MOOCs inside China but also outside of China. So Shuitang X, which means learning place, is the third biggest MOOC provider in the world by volume. And it provides material to universities across the world, students, and the public. There is, associated with that, a new platform developed in the last 3-4 years called the Rain platform, which basically integrates WeChat, social messaging app, and PowerPoint and video functions. So you can have a video and show your PowerPoint. There are other platforms, but that one is developed within Tsinghua. So we have a situation where we could readily turn to use our own platform for doing this sort of emergency online learning.
So is that where most of these 4,000 courses are being hosted?
You know, it's quite a mix. And I think one of the real secrets to success in being able to turn a very elite campus-based institution into an elite online provider in 2 weeks was to basically say to the faculty, which is exactly what our leaders said to us, is go ahead and do what you can and use what it takes to get the job done for our students. And it was a clear message of direction and clear support from the leadership and the support networks in the university to help faculty convert their often very traditional approaches to teaching into very high-tech approaches. Now, for some people who teach a class by starting at one end of the blackboard and finish when they reach the other end of the blackboard in terms of equations, that involves standing in a lecture classroom on campus and basically filming them doing that for their students in a lecture. For others, mm-hmm. it involves buying new IT equipment. And I think it was that trust and confidence in the faculty to basically use whatever it took to get the job done that helped make it happen.
Tsinghua is about 6 weeks in, so you're probably a month or so ahead of what some of our listeners in Europe and the US, where they are right now. Can you give us some mistakes that you learned from in the process of taking everything online?
Well, we haven't really got to the point of sitting back and thinking what it all looks like and what lessons we've learned. Because we're still, I would say, pushing forward moment by moment to try and keep students engaged. And bear in mind, the students are all across China and the world as well. So we're still very much focused on delivery, but not yet sort of evaluation and learning lessons. But it's quite clear that keeping students supported is different when people are sitting at home. And bear in mind, a lot of these students are needing to be inside their own houses and apartments too. A different form of student support is required. It's also, of course, the fact that we can't do as many enriching activities with our students. You know, one of the courses that I teach, I actually take my students around the campus and we visit different labs and areas around the university as we learn about higher education. I can't do that now, but I will start to do it by bringing colleagues from around the world. So that's a different form of enriching experience, but it's not the same as sort of going around the campus and sniffing out different labs and things like that. Of course, there are technology problems, and the technology, in my experience, and I've travelled quite widely across China, is pretty good, but not all of our students are in China, and so they may have trouble with the internet experience and things like that. We had quite an amazing finding from this is that a lot of our faculty, of course, are dedicated teachers, but they haven't necessarily had the professional development in how to be tertiary teachers or online teachers. What we have found is that has all changed. Essentially, most Provost's best dream has come true, in as much as almost every teaching faculty has now undergone a rapid self-paced course in online teaching, has traded hints and tips with colleagues, not just in China, but around the world. And they're also starting to do a lot of research on this. So it's had a really important impact on the faculty's capacity to understand what they're teaching is, and how they can go about doing the teaching in different ways. In terms of whether or not the students are actually learning what we want them to learn, which is what we're all in it for, it's too soon to tell. You know, we ask our students, we evaluate them formally, but we also ask them as we're doing our classes. And they seem to suggest that they're pretty happy with the experience, you know, offers all the flexibilities that we've grown to know and love about online learning, but it doesn't necessarily have the social supports that that we do expect in intensive higher education.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the next big challenges that you're going to be facing is the question of assessment, which traditionally in China, I know it's often been still the model of getting lots of people in one big room to sit down and all take the exam at the same time. How are you approaching online assessments?
So most assessment in higher education is still happening the same way it happened 100 years ago. It has been incredibly slow and difficult to reform. And I'm talking about, you know, most of the world's 20,000 universities here, not just China and not just Tsinghua. I'm currently looking at the building where I took a lot of my undergraduate and graduate assessments. And I know that we're to be open for examinations in 2 months' time. students would be going in there and sitting at small desks and regurgitating stuff that they crammed into their head over the preceding week. That's not the best way to test knowledge. That's not the best way to see if someone's a competent professional or expert. So again, what we've seen is that it has forced people to rethink how they can understand what their students are learning. And it's too soon to tell. Most of the midterms have passed and people have either reinvented the way they've done them or they've done different types of exams. But in about 2 months, the final exam season will come and people will have to think, you know, how can you authenticate someone's learning for assessment of higher education? And simply assigning grades, particularly when you're teaching cohorts of students who are amongst the most elite in the world, is a rather strange thing. There are some elite universities in the US that have as their educational motto, do no harm. The idea being that you can get super smart people and just expose them to a wealth of opportunities. And regardless of whether you give them an exam or not, they're still largely going to go on and contribute to changing the world. So I'm not sure that unless it's a gateway piece of assessment, it's really so high stakes for the student or so high stakes for the institution. What we do know is that it's providing good feedback to people to help them inform their learning that make assessment real. So the second part of your question, I suppose, Sarah, was more around student stress, student resilience. You know, we've seen an institution lead through crisis and be enormously resilient. And I suppose it's partly a matter of the faculty and the leadership to try and instill that culture and pride and commitment to learning to our students. That's where it's going to happen, through the faculty level supports. But as well, we're going to have to make sure that the students, you know, mentally are coping with their studies. An enormous amount of data and personnel are involved in doing that. You asked before about emergency online learning and sophisticated leading forms of online learning. And the professional service firms that do online learning at scale for universities hire many, many support personnel, counsellors, careers advisors, psychologists, learning advisors, and the like, to try and help students work through these issues. So that's a really important part.
Tell me about phase two of this for Tsinghua. What are you hoping to put in place as this kind of becomes more of a reality and you've got a bit more time to improve what you're offering to students? Would it be more support staff on the ground to be calling students and checking in with them and even the faculty perhaps included in that?
Well, I suppose that the initial interest is just delivering on the promise this semester. You know, we need to get the students through this course of teaching. It goes for more or less another 8 or 9 weeks plus assessments. And then it's the what next. And I think a really prudent move was made by our leadership early on to say, we have a huge natural experiment before our eyes. And unless we study this, we can't make the best improvements to our own university or contribute to future thinking about where higher education is going. Now, if anyone can find the magic formula that somehow blends campus platform and mobile phones and computers and aeroplanes to somehow stir together the perfect higher education cocktail, they will be able to solve the riddle that people have been studying for about the last 40 years at least. I suspect there is no one solution, but what we will look to do is to find ways to augment the campus. I'm aware that, you know, as things like augmented reality and virtual reality become more normal, we can augment the campus in all sorts of interesting ways that we wouldn't have thought about 5 years ago. And we'll also probably take out certain parts of the campus and put online experiences in there. So I would think what we will see is we will see, if you like, a twofer. We'll see campus-based elite residential education with an overlay of very rich online learning experiences. Mm. And hopefully that will enable our students to, you know, save time flying around the world and at the same time bring every guest lecturer you could ever imagine into the one classroom. I suppose now we have the shock that gives us the opportunity to really make moves in some of these directions. I think it's really important tonight, though, that what we're working through now is not about online learning per se. What we're working through now is looking at our major universities, and Tsinghua was the first, but quickly has been joined by very elite universities in the US, and I know European and other universities are struggling through this as well. It's about leading through crises and making institutions resilient and change in the face of contemporary circumstances. And in some ways, universities have been very good at that. In other ways, they're very resistant and very conservative. I would think in about 2 months, we'll have an amazing and I pretty much think unprecedented series of insights that we can share with the world as to what the future of higher education should look like. And, of course, in and around that, we'll have some new information about what good quality learning looks like. And that's the sort of stuff that we need to start telling the parents and the students of tomorrow so that they can prepare themselves and learn in new and different ways.
I just wanted to end, Hamish, on asking you how you're responding to this personally. How are you doing in lockdown, and how are you managing to stay in touch with your students and research and colleagues?
Look, in terms of my colleagues and my research, it's pretty global anyway. I have noticed that as the world has started to suffer the spread of this the virus, the emails tend to go quiet and for a couple of weeks, but then, you know, life generally goes on. So in terms of the research side and working with people all around the world, which is pretty much what I do daily, things are pretty much business as usual. In terms of dealing with students, and of course, our students are people who are going through transformative parts of their lives. You know, it'll be great to get back in the same room as them. But meanwhile, I think what we're doing with the online medium, and particularly with video conferencing, which has really matured in recent years, enables us to keep in touch through groups, through communities, through research groups, but also one-on-one, just to make sure that people are engaged in their learning and, you know, and hanging through. It's a pretty stressful time. So, doing a lot of video conferencing, a lot of online teaching. For me, it's about 6 hours a week right now in terms of formal teaching, plus the advising of my graduate students. And my graduate students are currently in six different countries, ranging from Brazil through to Spain. And all of Asia and Oceania in between. It's not an unusual experience for me because I've often had that sort of student profile, but, you know, it's unusual in as much as it's uncertain when I'll be able to get back in the same room as them. So it's a fantastic time and a great opportunity to understand, I think, the future of higher education before our eyes. But really, a lot of higher education is just about getting people together in the same space and really having high-level, nuanced, very sophisticated individual conversations. So look forward to that in the, if not weeks, months to come.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time, Hamish. I really appreciate it. And best of luck in the coming weeks.
Sarah, thanks so much. All the best.
That's it for this episode of the Times Higher Education Podcast. You can find out more about how the coronavirus is impacting universities and academics around the world on our website, timeshighereducation.com, where we've made all of our coronavirus content free to access. And if there's anything you'd like us to cover on the podcast, you can send requests to me, sarah.custer@timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education Podcast.